Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
And you are back with Breaking Banks. This is the time of the year where we're reflective of the year in the rearview mirror and what's going to happen next year. And of course, for us, we've been running this show now for almost 7 years. In May, it's going to be 7 years. So we've got a lot of history to go over. But today's show is about what has happened in the last 10 years, because it's the end of the decade. So, you know, how has fintech changed our lives over the last 10 years? And joining me are our a troop of regulars. We have joining us from New York, Penny Crosbin, the editor-in-chief of... What's your official title, Penny? I was about to get it wrong.
Editor-at-large of American Banker, and happy holidays. Thanks for having me on your holiday show.
Editor-at-large, that's right. Now, Theo Lau is also joining us. Theo?
Hello, everybody. Happy holidays.
Thank you very much. And Jim Maroos, the guy behind the Digital Banking Report, Banking Transformed, and Jim Transformed.
Yeah, there we go. Glad to be on the horn today.
Yeah, and Ron Shevlin's joining us shortly, so it'll be great. So, guys, I thought we'd kick this off with, when we're trying to look at the last decade in terms of how fintech has changed things. Obviously, part of this is the emergence of the smartphone that happened, 12 years ago now, 2007. But in terms of fintech itself, when did you guys start to really identify yourself as part of the fintech decade? Was it before 2009? Was it after?
You know, for me, I think it was after. Trying to put ourselves back to a decade ago, I was just actually, I spoke to you, Brett, that this week marks the 10th year of me blogging, because that's the way I started. I blogged on my own and then joined the financial brand after that. But what's interesting is I really think 10 years ago, we were probably more looking at the globalization of banking as opposed to really fintech. There were a couple of players out there, but in the U.S. at least, we were getting more interested in the fact that there were going to be some global players and people that, you know, with the phone and with online banking, even that back then, we had a different rate environment. You know, we had a situation that, there was still some spread available. There was also the ability to make money by buying deposits in an online and a mobile banking world. And so, you know, things were starting to change from the dynamics of how you competed. But I'm not too sure how active fintech really was, you know, truly 10 years ago.
And Ron Shevlin has joined us. Ron.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I think you're right, Jim. I think, fintech was a bit of a term. You know, I think Ron and I were talking the other day on Twitter about David Jabino. And Dave Jabino had followed our blogs back in, like Ron was saying, 2008, was it, Ron, or 2006, right. And Banking for Tomorrow, I started in 2008, I think. And Jabino was one of the first there. But in those days, we were more talking about brands that could disrupt rather than fintech as a class. And it's quite appropriate on this anniversary show, or the decade in review show, that Bank 2.0, my book that sort of kicked off my career in this space, I actually finished the draft on Christmas Day 2009, so exactly 10 years ago. So, uh, But Ron, do you recall back in those days, were we talking about fintech as a class? Or was it more like we were focused on... I remember we used to talk about Bank Simple a lot and Square and, you know, some of the players, but...
No, we weren't using the term fintech. I mean, I wasn't. I know that. You know, it wasn't until much later on that I kind of got wind that, man, if I didn't change my Twitter handle to say fintech in particular, I was going to be missing out on a lot of followers. So, but, you know, at the time, I was talking a lot about how technology was changing things. We just weren't really using the term fintech all that often. But yeah, I think it was guys like you and Chris Skinner who finally introduced it as common terms.
Yeah, yeah. And Penny, when did you guys, when did you start to report on fintech as a thing, as a journalist?
Well, when I started here, I was tech editor at American Banker in 2011. We were using the term fintech. We had a Fintech 100 ranking that we put out every year. Excuse me, but it was the tech companies who were providing technology to financial services companies like FIS and Fiserv and right. OCP and companies like that. We definitely weren't using it the way people use it today as talking about disruptive challenger types of companies in the financial space. I would say... I feel like Simple and Movin were probably among the very first fintechs, the way I would use the term today, in 2009. But I would say it probably wasn't until about 2014 or so that we really started using that word to describe companies like Chime and Simple and Varo and, Digit and all the other kind of cool newcomers,
yeah.
Who I think really, it's like all those really clever companies with really good ideas, including Movin, all kind of pushed that whole idea forward and made it something that people had to pay attention to, especially the banks.
So I guess, Theo, Jim, when do you think the market started to pay attention to fintech?
I'd say I agree with Penny, right? A couple of years ago. I remember when I first started looking at it, I think amongst all of you, I am probably the newest and the most least seasoned of all, because I didn't start looking at it until 2015 when I was working for the giant nonprofit in DC. And I remember approaching a company called Simple. And I was looking at the product offering. I still remember this. I had a conference call with them, and I said, I really like what you guys are doing. I wonder if there's a way we could potentially create a solution for older people. And Penny, do you want to guess what they told me?
No.
We are not interested in old people. I remember distinctively, I'm like, wait a minute. Okay, let me take a look better. And what are all these fintech companies and what are they doing? And I think right before them was everything took off. And I remember searching for all of you, looking for, who is Brett and who's Jim and who's Ron, who's Brad and all of you guys. And I started understanding what the field was. And I think what that was back then when everyone is saying, fintech's going to eat your lunch, right?
I met Josh and Shamia in a hotel in New York. It was on the corner of Fifth Avenue and it's on the Central Park corner up there, but on the Apple Store side. And we met in July 2009. That's the first time I met them. July 2010. I'm off a year. And that was the first time we met. And we're talking about these fintech banks at the time, but the term neobank, I think Dave Birch was the guy to come up with that one, because we used to call them non-bank banks back before I think 2012 or something, but I think Birch coined the phrase neobank. Ron, does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I remember I wrote something well back, and I'd have to go find it now, where I was talking about Neo checking accounts, but I don't think I used Neo Bank. So Birch probably read something I wrote. You know how he's doing that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the terminology now is applied to things that were created, you know, a decade before this decade, which was like PayPal. I mean, PayPal was in 1999, I think it was. And you know, now we consider PayPal to be one of the bigger, you know, fintech organizations out there. And, you know, it does show that the payment space has, through this decade, certainly been the most active for fintech players and providers and probably had the biggest impact on traditional banking.
Hey, Brett.
Yeah.
Talking about terminology here, I think you deserve a huge, huge shout out for this. I was thinking the other day about some of the trends, you know, in 2019 going into 2020, and kind of joking to myself that, you know, if anything characterized 2019, it was the year that the VCs discovered embedded banking. And now they're like all over it, like flies on you know what. And it's so funny, you know, now they're writing all these articles about embedded banking. I think you probably even had that in Bank 2.0 10 years ago.
Yeah, it went through various names. So it was experiential banking or experience banking, and then it became...
Ambient banking, maybe?
Yeah.
Is that part of it, too?
Yeah, that was part of it.
Yeah. But, you know, that term has really entered the lexicon now in 2019. But, you know, I give you credit because you were talking about that close to 10 years ago.
Well, you know, well, I guess...
And you look at...
No, Jim, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I was just going to say, and you look at, you know, the dialogue and with the dueling books between Chris Skinner and Brett, that dialogue started so early between the two of them and others in the marketplace that... And really kept it going. And now it's almost, as you said, Ron, almost like deja vu, where you start saying, geez, you know what? Haven't we revisited this place before?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it was one of those things where, it was fairly obvious directionally where we were going, that the technology would lead to more instantaneous access to banking services. But it was that sort of the trick was most couldn't see that it wouldn't just be the products you got in the branch on the phone. Right. The really interesting stuff that's happening now, of course, with Alipay and Tencent WeChat Pay and even, Max Levchin, Affirm, you know, here in the US and so forth, is the fact that, for example, credit access is being detached from a credit card as a product because it's easier to deliver credit access without the product structure. And that's something that I guess most of the banking industry didn't see coming, still don't necessarily see coming, you know. And I think that's really the promise of fintech, not the fintech that Penny was talking about with the vendors and stuff, but this sort of, the fintech of the last decade has shown us that it's possible to design banking better for customers. And not just iterating on the traditional model.
Well, and I think, you know, to your point also, when you look at the last 3 to 5 years, that's where the consumers really become very active in the demand for the better services. You know, a long time during the beginning of the decade, it was really the organizations building without an audience. Well, now the audience is not only there, but they're demanding the type of service they're getting from other tech companies. So they're the awareness of what can be done makes it so, you know, you see numerous consumers going to banks and getting on Twitter and getting on Facebook and complaining about, this is not the experience that I expected. And they're not comparing them to banks, certainly not the banks of yesterday.
I give a lot of credit to the iPhone, right? So if you think about what it has enabled, we literally have a mini computer in our pocket. It's so much more powerful than a lot of the older computers that we used to have, the desktops and the laptops. And so yeah, one of the great that power, right?
One of the great stats I used to use, Theo, is a smartphone in 2015 had as much processing power and storage capacity as Bank of America had in its entirety in 1985.
Yep. Exactly. So when you have that, you enable new business models to be created. You enable new companies to think of different ways of serving customers. And so it's just the whole world is evolving, as you say, a decade.
All right. So who do you think in, like Penny, you mentioned Simple and Moovin, but of course we had a second wind of fintech coming out of the UK. But who do you guys think were formative companies in terms of really changing the dialogue from fintech being this interesting experiment running under the side, you know, of the traditional system to being, oh, hang on a second, these guys are actually, you know, going to change the world?
I mean, I would say Chime and MoneyLion both kind of got people's attention. They both have more than a million customers now. I think for a lot of years, the bank, the traditional banks especially, said, oh, these companies don't have any scale. They don't have market share. I'm not going to worry about them. But over the last couple of years, they have started to get some scale, and they have caused a sensation and a true disruption in the industry. I also feel like all the companies that have brought a few fresh ideas, like Digit with its automated savings, and the companies that are starting to give people a better look at their whole financial picture, I think they're really having an impact. I think the rest of the industry is saying, we need to offer this too. You know, yeah. Bank of America now has Erica that provides insights about subscriptions and your spending if you're not going to be able to afford an upcoming bill. I feel like everyone now feels like they have to get to that because the fintechs came in and showed what was possible.
Absolutely. And joining us from Woking in the UK is Dave Birch. I assume you're in
Woking. Hey guys, how's it going? Yeah, good. Yeah, I'm back in Woking for Christmas. Wouldn't Very be anywhere good. Else.
Are you woke? Though, that's the question.
There's nobody more woke, Brett, you know that.
So we were having this debate, Dave. Was it you that coined the phrase neobank?
I don't think I coined it, but I certainly did overuse it on my blog. But,
you popularized
Yeah, I still think it's a good description.
So in we're talking sort of decade in review of fintech.
Yeah.
From a UK perspective, when do you think the UK market really realized fintech was a thing?
Well, I think it had some different trajectories here, didn't it? Because, you know, in the US, there was already, you know, kind of, you know, the innovation, technology-led innovation underway. I think what was a bit different here was that we had a slightly different kind of regulatory path. Because you know, we've been moving towards open banking, payment institutions, electronic money regulations. So it's been a kind of a slightly different path. And then out in the physical world, we all went mad for contactless. And so I think our trajectory has been slightly different. I do agree with that last comment, though, which is that we seem to be moving toward a more general trend. At the start of the decade, it was about individual products and services. As we move to the end of the decade, it's beginning to be about improving consumers' overall financial health, not just with regard to their bank account and payments, but with regard to mortgages and pensions and savings as well. So I do agree with that overall trend of more integration, but we've taken kind of a different path. And actually, because of open banking, I think the start of the new decade sees different kinds of innovation here, which I think are a little different from the US.
Yeah, I definitely think the UK with open banking and the Challenger Bank licensing has, it's done the UK market, you know, significant advantages in terms of the innovation push generally. But Ron, what are your thoughts?
I'm going to put my vote in for a company that actually did not start off as a consumer-facing company. I think it was Square. with their merchant acquisition and their little dongle that really made people realize, wait a second, there's a whole untapped market, at least in the merchant side, around card acceptance. And then they got into the consumer space. But, you know, I think even though they weren't consumer facing, I just think they kind of opened the door. And the other one that I would point to, and I think in a very quiet kind of way, or again, not consumer facing, I give Plaid a lot of credit. And I know they're kind of having taken their lumps these days for a number of issues, but, you know, they really enabled a lot of that back end connection to the fintechs that enabled a lot of the money movement. And I think they don't get enough credit for kind of helping to accelerate some of the growth of the fintechs.
I think
I
think Square was one of the first to really crack alternative acquisition, right, in terms of acquiring customers, that was not in the traditional modality. And that was sort of a pretty big deal. Theo, did you want to add something?
Too. Oh,
sorry, you go ahead, Jim.
I was just saying that, there's just the fact that, interesting that a decade ago, Mint got acquired by Intuit. And I guess when I look back and I say, geez, as a surprise that they have not become a bigger player, have not really moved from where they were in the beginning, a lot of organizations have taken some of the concepts that Mint had, but they never really grew to where I think if you look back, you'd think, boy, you thought they would have been a player because they were one of the first ones to look at, integration of accounts, the whole budgeting app thing. And they kind of lost some of the mojo and momentum, I think.
But you know what, Jim? That just goes to show, in my humble opinion here, that convenience trumps advice. And PFM. I mean, I think that was the failure of that, is they overestimated how many people really wanted all these PFM things. And what people really want most is convenience, just make it easier for them. And I think you got to criticize Intuit for not doing more. I mean, Intuit's such a brilliant company over the years, but did not do a great job with Mint. But, think
That's where Moovin' and Simple really showed the way of what the future is going to be, which was embedded budgeting tools and not necessarily show me how to budget, because we all remember the beautiful diagrams and the circles and the quadrants and all that. But really what people wanted was show me how I can save money. So show me how I can reduce my costs of borrowing. And you know what? I'm pretty good with that. I don't want more education. I don't want to do it myself. I need it to be embedded.
Embedded and contextual, right there at the point of interaction, not where you 6 hours later at 11 o'clock at night, you go on to log on your PFM. And what were you getting? Just offers from Charles Schwab to open up a brokerage account. I think that
a reduced interest rate credit card. But we worked out fairly early in the process that it was all about behavior. At the same time you had Fitbit and these other sort of behavioral gamification tools coming out, and we just worked out that if you look at fitness and you look at financial health, there was very strong correlations psychologically around who could use a tool like Mint to actually save money. And it turns out as a very small percentage of the population, like 10-15% of the population, because they're just not disciplined. Most people aren't disciplined enough to take the education or take the learnings from data that would be presented on a Mint-type platform and change their behavior. And so you need something that actually modifies behavior.
Yeah, behavior change is really hard, isn't it? And that's why I like apps like Acorns, for example. If you think about set it and forget about it, and in the background, it helps to, we can say it doesn't save up enough for retirement or anything like that, but at least it's enough for rainy day or a little bit of a spare change in the back that most people don't think about.
I think the issue is that it's very difficult to give people advice about any kind of financial product that's more complicated because it's complicated. And because telling people like me, you've got these options for pensions and things, is pointless because I don't understand them either. So I think where we're coming from are these first steps, which were great. but I've got a feeling that the next phase of the evolution is going to be very different, because if you're telling my AI about, or I've got AI on my side to help me make these decisions, I can make much more complicated decisions, and that means you can sell me much more complicated products, which have very different characteristics. So I've got to, the thing moving towards financial health doesn't mean just looking at the things we have now, the existing pensions and mortgages and so on. It gives the industry the opportunity to develop more complex and more sophisticated products, because they'll be selling those products to machines and not to people. So I think that direction is really exciting. Those first steps were great, but I think the way where they're going, I think, is very different.
And all right, let's change tack a little bit. Who was the first fintech unicorn you guys remember being identified as a unicorn?
Well, that probably was PayPal, wasn't it, I think?
I guess. Did we call them unicorns back then?
No, I don't call them unicorns now, because unicorns didn't exist, whereas billion-dollar companies do. So that's why I don't call them unicorns. The point about... they mean something that's rare, and a unicorn isn't rare. It's non-existent. They should call them Yangtze River dolphins or something like that. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, no, but you want something that's unusual and rare, but actually exists.
Dave, you're missing the point.
Unicorns don't exist. I don't want to break it to them.
Dave, you're missing the point. They are unicorns, because unicorns are fictional, and so are their valuations. So it actually is.
That's a very accurate description. But yeah, I mean, don't you guys think it was PayPal? I think it was PayPal that
PayPal was definitely the first, but in the more in this decade, because PayPal actually predated their acquisition they were well on their way to unicorn status by then when they were acquired by eBay prior to their separation.
I would guess Square or Stripe, but I haven't analyzed it.
I think you're right. Square or Stripe. And then you had the secondary, you had the TransferWise's and others sort of coming after that. All right, so if from a consumer perspective, Ron, you've talked about Square as a milestone. Go, Dave.
So I was just going to say, because there's a lot of things in there, I'm thinking things like Klarna and so on, which weren't just unicorns. They were unicorns that sort of brought a new product. I mean, Stripe and Square are like pretty cool, and they're fantastic companies, but they're just, you're just taking credit cards. I mean, it's interesting in kinds of acquisition, but I think we should put a flag up for the companies that actually brought in a new product, which we didn't have before. And so that's why I kind of think about things like Klarna as being quite game changing.
Apparently now there are things called Hacktacorn. I didn't even know that.
What's the $10 billion companies?
Over $100 billion. Those are called Hacktacorn. That is
what?
Weird.
Name one. Name one.
I'm going to find one. Keep going. I'll find
100
one
billion? Oh, well, that's yeah. Well, the only one would
billion?
Be the only one would be Ant Financial, right?
I would think they are the largest. You're correct. Let me look. I when you guys were talking, I'm just looking it up, but apparently now there are over 400 unicorns around the world, and there are decacorns. I believe one of the Southeast Asian companies are one. And then now there are hectocorns.
Well, they would not necessarily be in the fintech space, though, too, right? Because valuations of companies could be any type of company, could it not?
And would you consider Ant Financial fintech?
Yeah,
I would. Absolutely.
Yeah,
I would. In fact, it's the largest fintech in the world, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
It's the largest private company in the world, which in itself, I think, says something, right? That fintech has produced the largest privately owned company in the world. That in itself speaks, I think, volumes to the fact that in 2009, a decade ago, we would never have imagined that the largest privately owned company would be a fintech.
And let alone
that's true as well.
Right?
I mean, I suppose you Sorry, I didn't mean to cut across you. Well, I was going to say, you know, a decade ago, a lot of these we wouldn't have imagined because we didn't think that. So you know, a decade ago, I wouldn't have imagined there'd be somebody like Adyen or somebody like Stripe, because you just assume that the big players would, you know, you just assume that, you know, I don't know, Worldpay or somebody would come up with these new products and services. And I guess what we forgot, or at least people like me who spend far too much time talking to banks, is that just because they could, I mean, just because they have the technology and budget, just doesn't mean they will, because you have to have that kind of more entrepreneurial mindset, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, or look at somebody like Xero. You know, I mean, so it was just an accounts package. I mean, surely anybody could have come up with that. But they didn't. It took somebody new to come in and do something which other people could have done but didn't. It's an interesting category.
Hey, guys, let's take a quick break. And then after the break, we can talk about some of the changes that you guys have personally faced over the decade as a result of your involvement in the space. All right?
Okay.
Okay, cool. So let's take a quick break. You're listening to the end of year show from Breaking Banks. We have Theo Lau, Penny Crosman, Jim Marus. I always got to check myself. Dave Birch and Ron Shevlin joining us for this show. We'll be back right after this break.
The latest business information is made simple with the Voice America Business Network. The professionals in the business world bring you live talk radio shows featuring an array of business topics, strategies for building wealth, sales and marketing, stock trading, investing, and business technology. Voice America business hosts are professionals in their fields and bring to the airwaves weekly business discussions that offer up-to-date information, advice, and education. The Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business talk.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
And we are back from break. You're listening to Breaking Banks. This is our end of year special. Joining me from all over the world, well, actually UK and US, we have Penny Crosman here in New York. Penny?
Hello.
We have Jim Marus. You're in Ohio today, Jim?
I am in Ohio.
At home. Is it snowing?
No, it's 55 degrees.
Oh, my goodness. Ron is up in the Boston area, Massachusetts.
Correct.
And Dave is in Woking. Where is Woking in respect to London, Dave?
Sort of southwest of London.
Southwest. And Theo, you're in Washington today?
Yes, I'm home.
Very good. So a bunch of our regulars on the show over the last 10 years. So let me start with Jim, because Jim, you've been on a bit of a transformational journey yourself recently. But over the last 10 years, what would you say have been the biggest changes for you personally as a result of your involvement in fintech?
Well, yeah, I you know, 10 years ago, I was still working in the marketing services division of a check printing company, selling direct and digital marketing to financial institutions. But at the same time, actually 10 years ago, I believe this week, was when I started writing about the industry on a blogging basis on something that I had developed myself. And within 2 years had enough followers and readers that I said, you know, we got to move this. So I joined Financial Brand and then bought almost in the same month the digital, or was then the online banking report from Jim Bruni. And
the founder
started,
of,
you know, it was right. And you know, you look back, and 10 years ago is when also I joined Twitter. and LinkedIn was getting some legs, and so that became a platform for communication out to the marketplace as to, you know, my writings would never have gotten out of the United States if it wasn't for social media. And then, you know, most recently, this year, 4 months ago, 5 months ago now, started the Banking Transform podcast. But it's been an amazing journey, and it's, you know, it's one of these things that, with the financial brand and all the other things, it's really more of a media company. I'm more of a publisher and a media company, no longer working as a, you know, either as a banker, which is where my career started, you know, a few decades ago and then some, and or as a providing services to financial services companies.
And Penny, have you found that, you know, because you've not specialized in fintech, but it's obviously been a large part of your personal direction, but also for American Banker generally, you know, how influential has that been in your career over the last decade?
Yeah, it's had a really big impact. I mean, for one thing, there's a lot more competition from people like Jim and others who, it seems like almost everybody has a fintech blog, a fintech podcast. So it puts more pressure on us to really try to keep our game strong and make sure that we are, you know, doing our very best to cover this industry along with the more traditional banking industry that we have covered for all these years. And, you know, and that's all to the good. There's a ton of new companies to write about. It's also made my job more interesting, I think, because I find myself talking to fintech founders who have really different backgrounds and new ideas and sort of a different motivations and different perspectives on how to make banking easier to do or financial services easier to do, how to broaden access to people who may have been underserved before, people with lower incomes or people with problems in their credit files. There's been a lot of work done to try to look at providing credit in a different way, look at providing even accounts in a different way so that there are more people who can get them. And, you know, obviously a lot of brainy people, a lot of creative people who've been designing interesting new apps for consumers and for small businesses. So, you know, I think it makes it more challenging.
It's
and
more dynamic. It sounds like it's a much more dynamic reporting.
Yeah, field. Right. Yeah, it's definitely.
Which would have to broadened. Be interesting, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's broadened who we talk to and how we talk to them. And it, you know, it definitely brings it gives us more of a chance to talk to the people who don't necessarily like banks, you know, because it's less of an echo chamber and it's more of a lot of people I talk to are very critical traditional finance.
Yeah, no, I think that's sort of, many fintechs have said that their response to the cause for them building their business. You know, founders talk about their frustrations with the existing system, you know.
Exactly.
Josh spoke about that, so, you know, from Simple. So, Dave, you know, you were involved in fintech before it was called fintech, of course, you know, famously, for example, working on M-Pesa, you know, which became one of the success stories of the decade from a fintech perspective. But from your career personally, you know, what has fintech meant for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I was lucky because Consult Hyperion had this niche where we were doing the new stuff, which, you know, things like Mondex, M-Pesa, and so on. So I think I'd had a little bit of a heads up as to where the technology was taking us. And I'd had some other good luck because of Twitter and LinkedIn. It turned out I was good at Twitter and good at LinkedIn. And I won't pretend there was any science to it. It turned up I was good at it. Clients liked it. So that got me, you know, that got me because of communicating, and then it turned out I was okay at writing blogs and so on. But actually, I'm quite prepared. I know you didn't know this was coming. But I'm quite prepared to embarrass you about this, because the honest truth is, it's when I read Bank 2.0 and had the opportunity to meet you, and I realized, oh my God, people can get paid for writing this stuff. This was a new dawn to me. No, I don't mean it in a joke.
I'm still trying to get paid. Yeah.
I mean it in a completely serious way, Brett, because you encourage me to write. And actually, you know, once I'd written a book that had, you know, I flatter myself was reasonably well received, that took me down a different path. And I realized that, you know, consultancy had been great to me, but it wasn't really where my heart was in the future. Yeah. And that the communication side of things was really much more, you know, more for me. And so my life changed from being, you know, a pretty average consultant and, you know, to being an okay writer and speaker and so on. So,
well, you know, that's the other thing.
To embarrass you and point the finger.
You know, the family tree on speaking alone from Brett. I mean, I think we've all been impacted by that directly or indirectly, that to your point, not only can he get paid for writing, but heck, he can get paid for speaking too. You know, there's a lot of people that know that was never a problem for me. But to get paid. Yeah. In fact, my family usually paid me not to.
Well,
but I think it's an interesting time where you know, being able to communicate not just the facts, but being able to communicate the excitement and the feeling of what's going on. People value that, Jim, and it's turned into a very interesting business.
And Theo,
well, I mean, I think you,
sorry, go
the
ahead,
group
Jim.
Also, I'm sorry, the group also has all completely embraced what I'll call lifetime learning. I mean, there's not one of us that is the same today as they were a year ago. And that really differentiates, I think, many of the people in the space that we're familiar with, that it moves so fast that if you don't continually learn and distribute that learning, then it quickly passes you by.
Yeah. So Theo, yeah, you came into this sort of in the same way as a communicator, when was the moment you realized that there was an opportunity for you? And I know Brad and you were a partner on your podcast and so forth. But
my partner in crime.
Yeah. Yeah. when did you have that epiphany that this is what you wanted to do?
It was actually recent. So I didn't start joining Twitter until a couple of years ago. And so I'm a latecomer because my background is tech and telecom. And I knew about this Twitter thing. I'm like, what on earth is it? And then when I started traveling a whole lot more, I realized I can be everywhere all the time. So I joined Twitter, and that's how I found you guys. I still remember the first time I met you in California when I was lining up like a little fan, the big fan group that you have, and asking for a signature on the augmented book. Yes, I still have that copy in here. I'm like, oh my goodness, I need to meet him. And that was when I started my journey. And we started the company 2 years ago. And it's mostly because we have an opinion about basically everything, and we're not shy about sharing it. But within the bounds of corporate, there's only so much that you can say and do. And so that's we saw what you guys are doing, and we wanted to be part of the party. This is the first year that we have actually completed a full year doing work under unconventional ventures. So it's been fun. And I think I would say, I echo Sue Jim's point, lifelong learning. We need to keep changing, keep evolving, because I would say none of us are the same place that we were a couple of years ago, or even a decade, 2 decades ago. That's what makes it fun.
Well, you know, for me, you guys know, I've told this story numerous times, but, you know, Chris was a big influencer for me. As I was writing Bank 2.0, you know, we were going back and forward on this. He thought I should call it Bank 3.0. And so I said, well, you know, there's an opportunity there, but in the end, I think obviously worked out pretty well. Ron, you've made some changes personally. You've been obviously in the research area, but how has fintech changed your reporting on the sector?
Well, I guess in a word, immensely. I mean, it's funny. I mean, I had the benefit of having a bully pulpit at both Forrester and IT Group to get stuff published out. But, you know, thanks to Twitter, thanks to LinkedIn, that kind of equalized a lot of opportunity for other people to get their, you know, opinions out there. And I think to some extent diminished the value of just the pure research itself. And I mean, it made a lot of folks in the research industry realize just throwing numbers out there to the market isn't enough. You've really got to have good ideas behind them. So, you know, I think from a career perspective, gosh, it's a huge impact that Twitter, LinkedIn, and now being able to publish on Forbes has had on my career. I would say that, you know, undisputedly, I've got to be the absolute number one fintech analyst here in North Reading, Massachusetts. I don't think anybody beats me.
No, I would agree. I would agree. So, I know we're getting near the time to sort of wrap this up, guys, over the next 10 minutes or so. But let me ask you, you know, if you were to pick the biggest fintech moment of the last decade, and I know it's probably hard, and you can make it something personal or you can make it something newsworthy. You know, what would be the moment you realized fintech was you know, was going to be something special? Maybe Penny, do you want to sort of kick us off?
Yeah, it's hard to say, going back through my, you know, mental, you know, memory, it's hard to find a moment that jumped out. I mean, the thing that comes to mind is when the bank started making forging agreements with data aggregators, like someone mentioned before, Plaid, and I should have given them credit also, because they have helped really move things forward considerably by kind of pushing fintechs and banks to work together. You know, when Wells Fargo started signing agreements with data aggregators like Intuit and Plaid, and Chase followed suit, I think the big banks realized something major was happening here, that, you know, their customers wanted to use Venmo and Mint and Digit and all the other interesting apps out there, and that they had to go along, they had to accommodate. And to me, that kind of changed the dynamic a little bit, because it gave the fintechs an ability to do what they need to do to grab all that customer data that they need to fulfill the mission of their apps. And it was also sort of an acknowledgement that this world was changing, and that the banks had to kind of change along with it. So that was about 2005, I believe, 2005, 2006.
Yep. Jim, is there anything that stands out in your mind?
I think the whole perfect storm of when the fintechs came into play, where innovation became a big deal. So that would take the Finovate event concept. You know, there was a time when, not too long ago, that American Banker probably was more read for what was going on in the regulatory and the governmental space and back offices, and Financial Brand was read for what was going on in marketing. And, you know, overnight almost, the whole marketplace expanded from being boring banking to being an exciting industry that things are going on every day, and was catching the front page of Wall Street Journal, not because of mergers, but because of what was going on in the marketplace. I mean, just look at, I mean, I remember reading American Banker every day, and it gave you a good concept of where the industry was going, but I remember it wasn't the most exciting industry. With fintech and with all the new players and the innovations going on. Oh, and now everybody, you can actually strike up a conversation at a cocktail party, and people want to, well, actually stay with you instead of moving away. Because it's something everybody has a perspective on. I mean, people know what Alibaba is. People know what Tencent is. People know what SoFi and some of these other companies are. Where in the past, if you said anything about, you'd come up with any company, Citizens Bank, you'd number one have to distinguish which Citizens you were talking about in which region.
Right.
But now it's an exciting world that really has expanded exponentially.
So Ron, have your daughters finally recognized that you're in a cool sector?
Oh, absolutely not. No way. The only redeeming quality I've got to earn my daughter's respect is that to this day, Lindsay Lohan still follows me on Twitter.
And
I think you guys too, actually. So, you know, that was about the only one. But, you know, to answer your question, Brett, about the moment, I got to give Josh and Shamir the credit for this one with Simple, Bank Simple at the time. You know, I think it was at that point where, you know, here's two guys who start this piddly little company to, like, try to reinvent banking. And, you know, think about the failures of Wingspan Bank before that and Bank of Internet and all of the digital stuff that had really kind of failed beforehand. And here was all this interest that they were getting in this. And I think I give them the credit for kind of really flipping the switch on a lot of people's minds that this is going to be for real.
Yep. And Dave, you...
Yeah, well, Simple's a big one. And I certainly remember when I first went there to meet the guys, I was really... But I think I'd probably point to...
Did you meet them when they were in Brooklyn?
No, this was in Seattle.
Oh, you went after they moved to Portland. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And I still have a Simple account, which I still use. But I point to something. You said earlier on about challenger banks, and you know I'm not crazy about the terminology challenger banks because I'm not convinced they're the actual challengers. I still think big tech is the challenger. So for me, the two sort of big things are kind of the big tech thing. So it was probably Apple Pay, which was 2012 or something. So, and Apple Pay was amazing because how conservative it was.
Yes.
Like amazing new technology. But actually everything's running on the same old rails. I mean, I'm sure Apple have a long-term plan that I don't know about, but it was a surprisingly conservative.
But we were waiting for years for them to come out with NFC as well. It seemed like 3 years, right?
Well, and in fact, they, because of their decisions around NFC, they essentially stopped that market, didn't they? They ground to a halt. So that was surprising because it was so conservative in a way. And then towards the other end of the decade, you've got Facebook Libra, which, whether you think Libra will ever launch in its current form or not, does put down a marker that there is really, really big change coming. So I tend to look more at the techs than the fins, if you see what I mean. If you're asking me about what was kind of, you know, what sort of set the path was the conservatism on one hand of Apple and the I don't know what the word for this. I imagine there's some long German word for this overreach. the Facebook going with Libra. And so those are markers for where we're going in the next decade, I think.
I remember talking about German. I remember interviewing N26 in the Moven offices before they were a thing. And now look at them. One of the great things about this radio show is a lot of these guys, you know, the TransferWise's, the N26's, Starlings, and these guys, you know, have all been on the show fairly early on their cycle. So we've been able to watch them grow as part of the show. It's been pretty cool. Well, listen, guys.
But actually, that's one of the reasons. Oh, sorry, didn't mean to.
Go ahead, Dave.
I was just going to say that's one of the reasons why I like the podcast, because, you know, you do get a spectrum of people on it. And I like to hear people that I don't always agree with. I mean, I don't want a love-in. I want to learn stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, getting that spectrum up there, I think, is really, even when you think you know all about it, like I do, you know, it's important to hear that spectrum. So thanks for that, man.
No, well, thank you for joining us. Thank you all. Ron, Jim, Theo, Penny, Dave, thanks for joining us on our Decade in Review show, and just 30 seconds. What have you got planned for next year, Jim?
Try to perfect what I got. I got a lot of things going on, trying to make them all better, including myself.
Good. Ron?
more FinTech Snark Tank and taking that and creating more moments of snark for Breaking Banks.
Awesome. And Dave?
I'm starting my campaign to have the Queen removed from banknotes in the UK and replaced it. But because she has nothing to do with the history of money. I want Sir Thomas Gresham on the banknotes, the man who founded the Royal Exchange.
There you
Britain's
go.
First economic terrorist.
No, we should have Isaac Newton on there. The founder of the Royal Mint, himself. Right? Yes, yeah, exactly. That makes sense. Theo?
What did the Queen have to do with it? That's what I want to know.
We are going to continue on our journey of trying to change the minds and hearts of people that you can do well while you do good.
Very good. And Penny?
Echoing what several other people said, just trying to improve our coverage, improve myself in any way I can.
Awesome. And myself, you guys know I've got a big book coming out next year. I'm still writing it at the moment, but that's my plan. That's my plan so far. Get to middle of the year and launch Techno-Socialism. So,
yeah, you and Chris, right? Chris
yeah, we're both. Yeah, Chris is going to beat me to it. His book's going to come out before me. So, but of course, it's no doubt going to be a success. Chris's book, as always. So, thank you all for joining our show and review, and have a great Christmas and New Year break.
Thank you.
Happy Christmas, guys. Thanks.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
That's it for Breaking Banks, guys. We will see you again next year. Bye.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.